a big fireplace, a great room, we could call it, instead of an auditorium. Big fireplace. Tom could come early and get it started, that sort of thing. Keep wood cut. 1 Samuel 21. We begin tonight on a new phase of David's life. Chapters 19 and 20 have been given, well, actually chapters 18 to 20, have been given to the subject, or that first great move in David's life, life in the royal court. And we saw in that episode of his life, in that time of his life where he becomes the anointed king, or having become the anointed king, he is brought into Saul's court. He ministers to Saul on the harp. He becomes a fugitive. Chapter 21, all the way through chapter 27, the next great movement in David's life, the adventures of a fugitive. And David now is considered the outlaw. He is the king-to-be on the run, the persecuted one, the pursued. Many of the Psalms were written with this part of David's life as the background. I'll try to point some of those out to you. It might be an interesting study on your own if you could read those Psalms that are associated with the events of this part of David's life. If you have a good marginal Bible, which has some good references in it, you will see along the way some Psalm indications that you might choose to read, as I'll show you in one or two places tonight. So this is a period in David's life when I think it's safe to say that he experienced the greatest adversity that he did in any other time of his life, with possibly the exception of the year that he was out of fellowship because of his sin with Bathsheba. He refused to confess the sin for that year. He almost died that year. But this is a time of a different kind of adversity. The adversity that he experiences in this phase of his life is not because of sin that he's committed, but it is because of the sin of the one who is pursuing him. You and I as Christians will face different kinds of suffering. Much of the suffering in life that we experience is not because of sin that we commit. That's hard to get across to some Christians. They think that because they are suffering, that God has pulled their card again, and it's time to work them over, and God is getting them for something they did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, as if God went about just seeing how often he could get us back for that sin or for those sins. And so therefore, many Christians immediately assume because they enter into adversity that God is rebuking them. But you can study in this section of David's life the lesson that often adversity comes not because we have sinned, but because others are sinning around us, or simply because of the very curse of sin on the human race and in nature, that we catch it. We catch the fallout from this sinful world. And David catches the fallout from sin, which is maximizing itself in a man's life. And Saul is going to be an instrument in David's life to teach David much. It reminds us something of the life of Jacob and how God used Laban in Jacob's life. That God will often bring into our life somebody like a Laban, somebody like a Saul, who will be very difficult to get along with, to say the least, who actually may have open hostility toward us, somebody perhaps you have to work with, or live with, do business with, someone that will make life very difficult for you. And there are some very special attitudes and some very important principles that you need to know to live by in a situation like that. And David will help us in this, because I think overall he gives us an exemplary attitude of how to handle those who wrong us. Let's study that, beginning in this 21st chapter. The first part of the adventures of a fugitive is the tragedy at Nob. The tragedy at Nob. Let's pray. Lord, give us clear clarity of thinking tonight. May none of the daily pressures of life cause us to be distracted from our study, but may your Holy Spirit illuminate our mind as we observe the text, so that it may be translated from the printed page to a thought in our mind. And Lord, we know that you are sovereign over this entire process of taking the thought which was in your mind, bringing it through the writers of Scripture, placing it upon the pages of Scripture and preserving it and bringing it to us so that it might become a thought in our mind. Now, Lord, may your thoughts, therefore, become our thoughts as we study your word in Christ's name. Amen. The first episode of David's life as a fugitive is the tragedy at Nob, beginning in verse 1. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Now we have to identify some geography. There's going to be a good deal of movement in David's life from one place to the other as he is the pursued. Most of it is going to take place in the southern part of the land, in and around the Dead Sea area, around Jerusalem. Here is Jerusalem. To the north, approximately 1 mile, the city of Jerusalem can be seen from Nob. So David has gone in that direction, in the direction of Nob. He's seeking refuge from Saul. He has probably gone to the high priest, Ahimelech, for counsel. He has gone there for provisions. He's gone here for armor for his men, weapons. These were very practical reasons for David going to Ahimelech. David knew of Ahimelech from probably his years before, because Ahimelech had been probably very close and had engaged in a good deal of counsel with Samuel, the judge and the prophet. So he comes to him, and well, we're introduced to Ahimelech the priest. And it probably would help us to understand who he was and how he's related to some previous priests. And there is a problem that we have with this Ahimelech the priest statement, because in Mark chapter 2, another priest is said to have been in office at this time. So we've got a little bit of an apparent conflict, which I think can be easily resolved. It is said to be Abiathar. Let me take a minute just to draw you some kind of a diagram of how the priest have, how the lineage of the priest has gone on, say, back to the time of Eli. You remember Eli from the early chapters of 1 Samuel. He was the priest, the high priest, during the time when Samuel was born to Hannah. And then from Eli, we go down to two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And their life is a tragedy, to say the least, because these two young men both abused the priesthood. They were immoral men, and they were judged. Now, Phinehas had two sons, one Ahitub, I have to abbreviate here to the right, Ichabod and Ahitub. From Ahitub, we have two. We have Ahijah, and we have Ahimelech. So we see Ahimelech, of our passage here, is the great-grandson of Eli. Let me give you very quickly three statements about him so that you can be sure to understand who he is and what we will come across a little bit later in his death. As I've already said, he was the great-grandson of Eli. He was the father of Abiathar. Abiathar, whom we haven't put on here, is going to figure into the life of David very importantly. He will be the high priest during David's reign. But Ahimelech is the great-grandson of Eli. He also is known as Ahijah in 1 Samuel 14:3. We've already met him, but under a different name. Possibly that's Ahijah is a shortened form for Ahimelech. Like we have shortened forms for our names, Jim for Jimmy, bill for William. Ahijah is apparently either a shortened form of Ahimelech, or it could just be another name, maybe something comparable to like a middle name. There is a problem in Mark 2:26 because Jesus Christ, when he refers back to this event, he refers to the priest at this time as being Abiathar, who was the son of Ahimelech. I think the best solution to that is that what occurred is that the same occurred as did with some kings, is that often you would have two priests. You would have a high priest emeritus. You know how a president often in a college will serve for a number of years, and with age he then retires to the position of president emeritus. He isn't the president officially, but he is looked upon, he can offer some kind of wisdom and judgment on decisions. He is still looked upon in a sense as being a representative of the school, and though there is a president who is elect serving in the office. So I think that's probably what was occurring here, that Abiathar, Ahimelech's son, and Ahimelech's apparently old, very old at this time, and he was a high priest emeritus, and Abiathar, his son, served with him. All right, with that in the background, let's go down to the rest of this section. It says that they came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Now, you might understand his reticence in meeting David if you can remember that there was the strife between David and Saul was well known. Word had reached Ahimelech, undoubtedly, that things were not going well between Saul and David. There was strife in the family. This was Saul's son-in-law, but son-in-law and father-in-law were not getting along too well. And David comes not with the king and with these men and travel-stained. He doesn't know what's up. Are they on the run? Well, he probably, if he'd have followed that first inclination, he'd been right. And he's a little suspicious. "Why are you alone?" he's asked. And David said to Ahimelech the priest. Now, you might write to the side of this verse, David's second lie. Because David, on this occasion, becomes a situational ethicist. You know what a situational ethicist is? Putting it in other terms, it means, in this case, it's all right to tell a lie if that's the greatest good. Sometimes it's all right to tell a lie if it's the greatest good. That's situational ethics. Because situational ethics says that there is no universal, or shall I say, eternal standard. That standards vary over a period of time. And there are no fixed absolutes. And the way you determine a right and a wrong in a situation is by the situation and what would be the best in that situation. So David follows that ethic here. Situational ethics is nothing new. It's been around since man has sinned. It's a nice out. And it is, I'm not saying that everyone who does this, it's too high. Rose, it's a little bit too high. It's echoing. All right, that's better. Maybe up. Can you hear me all right in the back? All right, they can hear me. That's good. You can't hear on that? All right. Verse 2 now, you got his lie. He says, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you. And I have directed the young men to a certain place.'" So you see what he's saying. He's leading up to the fact that he is on a special mission from the king. Don't spread it around. Well, don't spread it around because I don't know where anybody don't want Saul to know where I am is what was in the back of his mind. But he's making it appear as if he's on a special mission for the king. "Now, therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found." So he is coming to the priest. This is where the temple is at this time. The ark, though, of course, is not there. But in the temple, the tabernacle, the temple hasn't been built yet. This temporary structure has been taken from Shiloh, and it's now in Nob. And in this tabernacle, you have the following furniture in the holy place. If I can draw it over here. This is the holy place. And you come in this front part. Now, I'm not drawing the Holy of Holies back here. There's an entranceway to that. You have the altar of incense right there. On the right, you have this table of bread, and on the left, you have the lampstand. And we're interested in this table of bread, that as you would have come through this curtain here, this passageway, into the holy place, you'd have seen that bread over to the right. And this is what is going to be the topic of conversation, is going to be the solution, apparently, to David's problem. Now, the priest answered David and said, "There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread." The Hebrew word for consecrated here is the word kadosh. It looks like this in the Hebrew. And, or as in this place, it's kodesh. That comes out K-O-D-E-S-H. Kodesh. This is word is the root word for the words that translated holy, holiness, separate or separation, sanctification, that whole family of words and ideas. But it means to be separate, to set apart for special use. So when he's saying the consecrated bread, he's speaking about what is known as the showbread, or the bread which is placed in the presence of the Lord. So there is, but there is consecrated bread if only the young men have kept themselves from women. Now let me take a few minutes to explain what this bread meant and why this conversation about sexual relationships comes up at this point. Let me explain it. The first fact you've got to notice is, or remember, is that the showbread was called several things in the Old Testament. And all of these are instructive because they help us to understand its significance. In Exodus 25:30, this bread is called the bread of face, literally. The bread of face. That is the word that's used in verse 6. You'll notice that it's called the bread of the presence. But the Hebrew word there is ha-panim. The panim is the face. The bread of the face. It is also called the bread as a memorial in Leviticus 24:5-7. Bread as a memorial. It is called in Numbers 4:7, it's called continual bread because it was kept out continually. Not the same bread, it was renewed every day, but it was continual bread. In 2 Chronicles 2:4, it's called bread of arrangement. The reason for that is it's arranged in two piles. There are six of these loaves stacked up in two piles. They're not loaves like we might think. I went into a bread store today and got all this bread stacked up all over the place. Just you can choose it, everything you want. White bread, whole wheat bread, a lot of things in between. This was unleavened bread and very, very thin looking. You may have seen this kind of bread. I'm trying to think of something to liken it to. It might look like a giant Ritz cracker. And if you've ever seen unleavened bread, then you know exactly what it looks like. So it was stacked up, piled up in these two groups of six. So you have the bread then designated in those ways, the bread of presence and so forth. Now this was the third article of furniture in the holy place, the other being the lampstand and the altar of incense. And it remained on the table for a week. I said a moment ago every day, but it remained on there every week and it would be changed on Friday before the Sabbath. It was removed and then eaten by the priest, but they were to have eaten it right here in the holy place. So when that time of day came, that part of the week came, that was the time to eat the bread, the old bread. Hot bread, new bread, was then brought in to be put in its place. Now under the Levitical law, only the priest was to have eaten this bread, the old bread, and only in the holy place, Leviticus 24:5-9. Now that's the background for the conflict that comes up, that Jesus Christ uses this event, we'll see in a minute, in Matthew 12. He uses this as an illustration to justify what his disciples did in eating on the Sabbath. This bread symbolized to Israel a very important thing. It symbolized to Israel their need for God's sufficiency. You can see from the 12 loaves of bread, of unleavened bread, the analogy or symbolism to the 12 tribes. And as these loaves of bread were stacked before God, in the presence of God, It was a symbol of Israel's, or the fact that God was the one who met their needs. He met their physical needs. But even greater than that, he met their spiritual needs. You know, Jesus Christ picked up on this in John 6 and spoke of himself as the what? The bread of life. And that they must eat him. That is, they must believe in him, receive him, appropriate him, if they would meet their deepest need, their deep spiritual hunger. Well, this bread in the holy place symbolized Israel's dependence on God to meet their physical needs and to meet their deep spiritual needs as well. Now, Ahimelech was deceived by David. David made him think that he was on a special mission under the authorization of Saul, that David wasn't. He deceived Ahimelech, and Ahimelech allowed David and his men to eat the older bread. They were about to bring in new bread for the coming week, so he allowed David and his men to eat. David deceived him. Now, I want to show you how this event is mentioned in Matthew, and Jesus Christ uses it as a case of precedent to handle the scribes and the Pharisees. Look in Matthew in chapter 12, and you will see that the disciples were accused by the scribes and the Pharisees of working on the Sabbath, because when they went through the grain fields, and as was the custom, or as was the pattern in those days, often a path that was used by the public would go right through a man's grain field. And the men, those who owned the fields, allowed it. And they would simply, in the spreading out of the seed in the furrows, the path would be left alone, so the seed would go on either side, and when you walk down through the middle of this path, on either side, at hand's reach, you could reach out and you could get some Quaker Puff wheat. Or you could get your cereal right there, dried cereal. You get your wheat germ. You walk along, you rub it in your hand, blow the husk away, and then eat it. That's what they did. Scribes and Pharisees said they worked on the Sabbath because they've taken out here this grain and they've eaten it. In verse 1, it says of chapter 12 of Matthew, at that time Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the grain fields, and his disciples were hungry. And began to pluck the ears of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. Now there's nothing in the Levitical law which prohibits anyone from doing this. But what they had done is built up a lot of tradition, part of which said that this was work. The Lord and his disciples were not breaking the Mosaic law. He merely defied the accretions that had built up around it. He defied social custom, and worse than that, it was pure legalism. And they are rebuked in this way. But he said unto them, Have ye not read what David did when he was hungry, and they that were with him? How he entered into the house, that is the tabernacle of God, and did eat the show bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them who were with him, but only for the priest? So the Lord shows that in the time of extreme human need, that the moral law precedes the ceremonial law. So we come back to Ahimelech and we say Ahimelech was not a legalist. Ahimelech was a man who recognized that human beings came before the ceremonial procedures of the law. People are more important than regulations. Now we're not talking about moral regulations. Because we get a contrast here where David breaks the law of God by lying. Ahimelech, though, sees the true sense of the law of loving thy neighbor as thyself by putting the human need above the ceremonial patterns. So this event was used by Jesus Christ as a precedent for the disciples. Now we're ready to go on to the event of David's the lie and some of the consequences. But look, you get the conversation in verse 5. Before they can eat this, they have to be sure that they are ceremonially clean. That is, there has to have been no sexual activity on the part of David or his men a day prior to the eating of this bread. So with that out of the way, the priest gave him the consecrated bread. And there was no bread but there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day. Now we come across one of the infamous clods on the pages of Scripture. There was detained before the Lord that day a man by the name of Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. Now, the fact that he's an Edomite and here in the temple area, tabernacle area, has given rise to some questions. How does an Edomite get into this picture? It's quite possible that he is a proselyte. After all, Saul has gone down into Edom and has won some victories there over the Edomites. He could very well be a proselyte to Israel. He may be here at the tabernacle fulfilling a vow, or perhaps there is suspicion of leprosy and he has to go through the ritual cleansing. We don't know. But there he was, and he's taking it all in. Because Doeg the Edomite was apparently one of these kinds of people that he was going to get to the top, and he didn't care what it took to get there. Doeg the Edomite was interested in one thing, Doeg the Edomite. And he was going to see himself being more powerful, influential than ever. He remembers this. David said to Ahimelech, "Now, is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent." He's lying again, of course, part of the same lie. Then the priest said, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it." Well, there is no other except it here. And David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." He ought to know. He's taken it from Goliath, and he has lopped off Goliath's head with it. And so he achieves his purpose, his objective here at the tabernacle in Nob. Now, I want to take this lie and come back to it in a minute and treat it in a couple of ways. I want us to examine David's lie, then I'd like to take the subject of lying just for a little bit and look at what the Scriptures have to say about lying and deception. But I want us to go on and see the aftermath, because David's lie, the story is not over. When you commit a sin, it always bears fruit. And this lie of David has children. And there are children that, well, you'll see the kind of consequences that come. But there's an interesting little interlude in verses 10 to 15 that we mustn't pass. David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. I hope this isn't lost on you where he's going. He must, in his fear of Saul. I would imagine David knew that Doeg the Edomite, he knew who he was and knew that it wouldn't take Doeg the Edomite to get back to Saul. So David moves from Nob over to the city in Philistia, Gath. You know whose hometown Gath was, don't you? Goliath. Well, here's David running from Nob, goes down to Gath, and in all things, he has Goliath's sword with him. Now, it has been a little while since he has killed Goliath, but David apparently thinks that he can get into this town incognito, and that no one would recognize him. He'd get lost in the crowds. But lo and behold, when he gets there, he's recognized. So it says that the servants of Achish said to him, Is this not David, the king of the land? Now, by his reputation and his victory in some battles, they know him, recognize him. Did they not sing of this one as they danced and sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? Well, they're remembering the number one song of the day. It had made its way down into Philistia as well. And when the Israelites would whirl around in the circles and dance, they would sing this song, and the Philistines had heard it, and they recognized David. What are you going to do now? Here is David in an unfriendly city, in the Philistine city of Gath, with Saul's sword, with Goliath's sword, being pursued by Saul. Oh, it's between a rock and a hard place. David. With an op. Out on some of my more relaxed moments. He disguised his sanity before them. He acted insanely in their hands. Scribble on the doors of the gate. Let his saliva run down into his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. It's working. Why do you bring him to me?" I mean, what Achish says here is that's all I need is another nut around my palace. He says, "Do I lack madmen? Am I so short of madmen that you've brought this one to act as a madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?" So David comes through with an Oscar-winning performance, running around the streets, drooling at the mouth, scratching nonsense on the gates of the city, and carrying on insanely, and so it works. They figure he's just crazy, he's gone bananas. I guess they think that because of all the being pursued and whatever else has happened in his life, that his faked insanity works, and he gets out. So David departed and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Now he heads back west over to the cave of Adullam. There are a number of caves in this area, large enough to hold this motley crew that David gets around him. 400 now, it's going to go to 600 soon. Look at the kinds of people that come in with David now. How would you like to have this in your army? As if David didn't have enough problems. Everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented, gathered to him and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. I have to attribute David's genius to the fact that he can take all these debtors and discontented people and can mold them into an army, into a fighting group, and loyal to him. I have to see David as being a good general, certainly an inspiring leader. Well, he goes from the cave of Adullam to Mizpah, Moab. So he swings out across the Dead Sea and goes over here to the land of Moab. And what he does is to take his mother and father over to that area for their protection. You think there is a good reason why he went to Moab? Quite possibly he went across. Listen, he's in enemy territory. Probably because of his ancestry. You know, David has an ancestor that was a Moabitess. Do you remember her? Ruth. And she is in David's ancestry, and I guess that might give him a foothold. Maybe that the king of Moab wants to make a bargain with him. I'll do this for you, David. You'll do this for me. So David takes his mother and father and leaves them there for their protection. Then he left them with the king of Moab. Verse 5, then here is a real encouragement to David. The prophet Gad said to David, he is going to be a very important person in David's life. Here is God's mouthpiece sent along to David. 1 Chronicles 29:29 indicates that he's going to be one of the compilers of David's biography. And he is going to be used in David's life to give him direction from the Lord. So David departed, and after having gone over to Moab, he comes back to the forest of Hereth. So he swings back, and Hereth is out here just to the east of Adullam, out in that vicinity. Now we get an interesting... It's almost like being a fly on the wall now for a few verses, because you're able to hear all the conversation in a little bit of a staff meeting. Saul and his cabinet are meeting about the situation, and Saul heard that David and the men that were with him had been discovered. Now this is the section where we're going to see that David's lie is going to bear fruit. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. You don't lie and get away with it. And it's going to do some damage. This is tragic. Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand and all his servants standing around him. It's a vivid description, and you can just see his garments ruffling in the breeze a little bit, and you can see the sun gleaming off his spear, and you can see his men standing around, and they're talking and murmuring what's up next, and Saul is squinting out across the distance and thinking about what his next tactic will be, how he's going to catch David. But he wants to chide his men, and he's going to work them over good verbally. Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Listen, Benjamites," I mean, these are of his own tribe here, maybe because these are some of the only ones he can trust. "And what will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? You know what he's doing there, don't you? He's saying if David gets in power, he's going to be more provincial than I am. He's going to be more prejudiced. He's going to favor those of the tribe of Judah. And you're going to be caught on the short end of the stick. See, all the good things that you're getting in the benefits of having me as your king are going to be gone when David's in power, for he's of the tribe of Judah. He's appealing to their greed. He's appealing to jealousy. And he is saying that they're going to lose out if David's in power. Now he says, well, for all of you have conspired against me. And he says, so that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you who is sorry for me. He's really feeling sorry for himself, isn't he? He's got a persecution complex. Everybody's against him. I think Saul knows he's fighting God. But the tragedy of Saul is that even though he knows he's fighting God, he only gets worse. He doesn't do anything about it. You know, you can do that, can't you? You can be fighting God but not do anything about it, but get worse. And this is what Saul is doing. So Saul wants them to feel sorry for him. And look, he maligns David. He says that he's my servant, is against me, lying in ambush as if David were a revolutionary, as if David were bearing arms to overthrow the king and the government. It was no such thing. He's misrepresenting David. You remember these things about this experience when you read Psalm 57, Psalm 34, Psalm 142. These and many other psalms come out of this experience in David's life. He knew what it was like to be one all alone. He knew what it was like to be pursued and lie down at night and not know if his throat would be cut. But yet he knew that he'd be protected by God. You read Psalm 2 and 4 and his fleeing of Absalom. Well, here we are. Guess who comes back on stage? Standing over the edge of the crowd, listening to the Saul verbally lash all of his men and try to make them feel about this small. Here is Doeg the Edomite. He was standing by the servants of Saul, and he said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. Yes, I saw him. He inquired of the Lord for him. He gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Saw it with my own eyes. Well, the king sent someone to get Ahimelech here, so he brings him down. Look down into verse 14. Ahimelech answered the king. Now, Ahimelech doesn't realize there's this big rift between the two, at least not in this the advanced stages that it is. And he says four things. He doesn't know it, but he's cutting his throat. One, who among all your servants is as faithful as David? Oh, Ahimelech, do you know who you're saying this to and what you're saying? Number two, even as the king's son-in-law. Number three, captain over your guard. I mean, how could David be your enemy? He's the head of your bodyguard. Four, is honored in your house. Ahimelech, you just signed your death warrant. That's what you just did. But he wasn't apparently aware that there had been this much of a rift between the two. Well, did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? I mean, I've been doing this all along, the king. But the king said, verse 16, now here is Saul, and this man is disintegrating. And you've seen this kind of behavior from Saul before. He is impulsive. He is emotional. He makes rash decisions in the heat of the fight. And his decisions, well, here's another one. You shall surely die, Ahimelech, and all your father's household. And the king said to the guards, literally this word is runners or footmen. The Hebrew is ratzim. Ratzim, runners. This was his own elite bodyguard. I mean, this was, what did Napoleon call it? The old guard. I mean, these were the men that were right next to him, the seasoned fighters, the one that he could trust. And he said, turn around, kill the priest. That's what they did. They can't do it. They didn't want to kill the priest. They recognized that the priests were God's, were the represented Israel before God. They couldn't do it. This is the second time that Saul has made a decision where it's resulted in his fighting men refusing to obey it. So rash. So what does he do? There's somebody there who didn't think twice about taking the sword. He's going to do it by himself. But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord. That's an act of civil disobedience. But then there is Doeg, the Edomite. You think he'll do it? He turned around and attacked the priest, killed that day 85 men of the cloth. 85 priests he butchered. But he's not through. He goes to the city of Nob, with his sword kills men, women, children, infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, all with the edge of the sword. But one son of Ahimelech got away. His name, Abiathar. He fled to David, and in verse 22, he comes to David, tells David, and David does something that is, it's what he should have done after he realized his guilt. I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Now, he assumes responsibility for his sin. Now, could I do something with this episode? Let me take this lie and let me turn it, just specifically and then generally. I want us to look at it specifically. Look at David's lie for just a minute. Then I want to take you through the matter of the, just a brief summary of the danger of deception. But I want you to see David's lie. Number one is that David lied to Ahimelech in order to get food for his men. He used a situation ethic. The end justifies the means. And he reveals to us by doing this, it gives us a good case study in the inadequacy of situation ethics. Now, I'll show you that in just a minute. But David used a situation ethic here to get this food for his men. I mentioned to you Sunday, and I will mention it again this Sunday, and you'll hear about it the next Sunday. It's going to be pinpointed for you. That what we are seeing in our day is the erosion of the biblical norms and standards that have been the consensus in our country in the past. I'm not saying everybody's not a Christian. I'm not saying that everybody has even known why they have done these things. But the consensus has been in the past a system of morality. But we're seeing that eroded now. And what is taking it place, its place are systems that have always been among mankind. I mean, they aren't recently, nothing's new under the sun. But we're seeing something take the place of biblical absolutes, biblical morality. What we're seeing take its place is the rise of hedonism, where the measure of good is oneself. Whatever is best for oneself is the greatest good. There is also the rise of utilitarianism. Now, utilitarianism is the philosophy that the greatest good of the greatest number. Now, you must understand that when this theory was developed by a man by the name of Jeremy Bentham, who lived in the latter part of the 18th, early part of the 19th century, and when he devised this ethic, this utilitarianism, his motive was good. He was simply trying to find a way, of course, ignoring the biblical absolute. That part of it was the evil. But when men try to engage in establishing truth apart from the truth that God's revealed, they always end up this way. Isn't that what Romans 1 says will happen? That they reject the truth of God that's revealed, they begin to speculate, then they begin to actually assert evil, and then the result is moral anarchy. That's the retribution. God judges them with their sin and the results of their sin. So this system of ethics called utilitarianism is the greatest good, the greatest number. And the idea originally was, we will determine what's right and wrong as to what is then best for the majority. That we will do. Now, that could work to some extent. If what? If everybody had a tendency toward benevolence and kindness. I mean, if you could be sure that what one would be the best for all is what is best for all, and that the person who decides that is going to be a benevolent person that is looking out for the genuine interest of others, it might work. But, of course, it can't. Because, you see, dictators take that concept, that philosophy, and they work out the greatest good of the greatest number. That was exactly the philosophy of Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. What was the greatest good? The greatest good was to exterminate the Jews. This is the same philosophy that the communists have used in this century when thousands, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians were murdered, when maybe at least 20 million Chinese have been murdered in the name of what? The greatest good or the greatest number. They looked down the years to come and felt that what would result from the slaughter of these people to bring about a communist regime and a communist way of life, that what would be the good that would result justify this. This is what's happened in Cambodia. Exactly. Where millions of people have been taken out of cities and marched out. They've died of starvation and 100 other kinds of awful deaths. Why? In the name of the greatest good of the greatest number. Now, you're seeing this kind of philosophy has made great inroads into our own way of life. A slight variation of it is pragmatism. There is some difference. And John Dewey, who lived in the latter part of the last century, I think he died in 1952. You know of John Dewey in our American school system, his philosophy that was behind it. Now, John Dewey's concept of ethics was that there is no eternal ethic. And that ethics are like grammar, and that as man first started to learn to speak in grunts and groans, and then as language has developed and evolved, and as it does change over time, so does morality change. It simply changes with the situation, and whatever works is right. This was John Dewey, whose name is often invoked by the liberals as if he's some patron saint. You know, John Dewey is responsible for the concept, the philosophy, the anti-capital punishment philosophy. I take capital punishment because I think it's kind of representative of a number of other things. Because John Dewey had a good deal to do with this thinking that says that what you should do with people who, let's say, commit a capital crime, commit homicide, is not take vengeance on them. Because no one person is to blame. Many people are to blame. So we have no right to take vengeance out on one person when many people or society is to blame. So what that person should be done, what you should do with this person is imprison this person and to rehabilitate and get them back out. Now that concept dominates the thinking today. And so Deweyism is this pragmatism, whatever works, and it's also a form of utilitarianism, the greatest good of the greatest number. But it does not accept an eternal absolute. It rejects the biblical authority and biblical absolutes. It's just another form of humanism, in other words. Now, you know of situation ethics. I don't have the time to go on into it, but it says that what decides a situation is not law, but love. And what is the most loving thing to do in a given situation would be the right thing. But this situation in David's life indicates the inadequacy of situation ethics. So a second factor here, I'm really taking all that time just elaborating on the fact of David's act of situation ethics, that he lied to Ahimelech in order to get food for his men. Did they need food? Sure. But did he do the right thing to get it? No. Secondly, then, David's lie solved the immediate problem but created a greater problem, and that is what situation ethics results in. David's lie solved the immediate problem. Was their hunger satisfied? Sure. See, we don't deny that a situation ethic may solve a problem momentarily. But in solving the immediate problem, it created greater problems. His lie led to what? The ultimate destruction of an entire city, all of its inhabitants, Ahimelech, and 85 priests in an entire city. That's what David's situation ethic resulted in. Because you see, in situation ethics, which says it might be all right to lie in a situation to bring about a good, that it cannot take into account what will be the good that will supposedly come out of this. I mean, it cannot contemplate the results that will come. You'd have to be omniscient to contemplate all of the results of this situation. That is why only God can set down, that is why God, in having set the rules, is the only one who can do it. He is omniscient. He said it's to be done this way because it's the expression of his moral character, but he sees the beginning from the end. And his omniscience puts the whole thing together. But man doesn't have this omniscience. So when he sets himself up as God to say what's right in a situation, he has this great blind spot. He cannot see what the consequences will be. Whereas God does see. You give him a point here. I'm getting a little philosophical tonight, but I think it's important to see that God sees the consequences of doing right because he has told us to do right and he sees the beginning from the end. He sees that he will rule and overrule in our life to bring about what's best. We are to do right and allow God to take care of the consequences. When we do wrong, we are saying we will take care of the consequences. See, that's it. And that's where David failed. So situation ethic is wrong, it's misleading. Thirdly, then, David should have told the truth, and turned the consequences of truth over to God. We had a little program on a few years back, you remember it, don't you? Truth or consequences. And David should have told the truth. He should have not lied. You say, well, his men would not have eaten. How do you know? How do you know what can be done? See, here again is when you set yourself up to determine what would be the outcome, you're trying to play God and act as if you're omniscient. You say, well, I've just got to lie. I've got to send that note off to school with Johnny and say that he was this when he wasn't. He was sick, but he wasn't. When that boss calls and you're laying out of work and you say, yeah, I'm sick today, I can't come in, but you want to go visit Aunt B up here in somewhere in North Georgia, and you're saying, well, I'm sick, I can't come in. That you are going to pay for that somewhere along the line. Now, that's not the only reason lying's wrong. Lying is wrong because God said it's wrong. It violates his holy character. But lying will bring about consequences that you can't even begin to foresee. You will pay a greater penalty when you lie than you ever would have if you told the truth. You tell the truth and let God take care of the consequences. At least. It's one of the most important commodities you can ever have. You'll have a commending conscience. Do you ever live with a condemning conscience? It's awful. You don't want to live that way. Now, you can cauterize it after a while, though, can't you? You can tell enough lies, it doesn't bother you. You ever met anybody like that? They just lie like that. They don't think anything about it. It's a way of life. Matter of fact, they lie so much they believe it themselves. Still lie, though. Well, they've created their own confusion and personal moral anarchy. Now, I know some of you work with people like this, and it puts you under some special pressures. But don't you ever get into any compliance with someone who is entering into a lie. And some people think they can do it to management just because they think management owes them something. But don't you ever be party to a lie. Now, you can lie in two ways. You can lie with your words or you can lie with your actions. Anything that intentionally misleads someone, that's what lying is. That's deception. Where you are intentionally trying to mislead someone. Now, you misstate something, give a factual error. Now, the key here is intent. But you can mislead someone by your words or by your actions. And neither of those are you to engage in as a Christian. It's a sin against God. It will always bring evil consequences. It will destroy your own soul, and you'll answer to it for the Lord. And there are various ways in which you'll answer to it. Now, I think that will be enough said about lying. I had wanted to go through a number of characteristics of this sort of thing. But let me add this. Let me add this about lying. There's no lie greater than God. God used this lie to complete a prophecy that he had made some time back. It astounds you, to just floors you with how his sovereignty is so great. It's an antinomy. I cannot fully explain it. Do you remember that God pronounced a curse on the house of Eli? Do you remember that? Back in the first chapters? Ahimelech's death was the accomplishment. Partial or part of the accomplishment of that curse that God pronounced on Eli. Now, that doesn't justify David's lie. God would have brought it about anyway. But God overruled David's lie and brought about this judgment on the house of Eli for his sin, the sin of his sons. So God is not, no lie is greater than God. I might point this out in closing, that Scripture is very clear on the fact that one of the marks of a decadent society is when it begins to maximize deception, fraud, and lying. 2 Timothy 3, Romans 1, when a society accepts the lie, and the article is used in the Greek there in Romans 1:25, the lie is rejecting the truth of God and setting up man. Humanism is the lie. That's it. Humanism is the lie. When man sets himself up as the measure of all things, the determiner of right and wrong, when he accepts that lie, God turns him over to all the consequences of his sin. He accepts other lies. And that fits right into what we're studying on Sundays. This is why the moral anarchy and confusion. This is why it should trouble your soul, but it should not shock you because you will understand what's happening. This is why the great confusion down here in our legislature. This is why these men cannot see issues like gambling as evil. They cannot see something like legalized suicide as evil. They cannot see abortion and euthanasia and legalized sin as evil. They cannot do it. Not all, but many. And the voting public is not the measure of morality either. Just because you get a consensus of people on a subject, that isn't the measure of morality. But why this confusion? I tell you, it's one of the marks of a decadent society. When a society rejects God's standards and accepts the lie, God turns them over to all the consequences of that lie. And that will get so bad in the tribulation. 2 Thessalonians says that God turns them over to strong delusion. They believe the lie of the Antichrist, so God just lets them have it all. Judge them. Okay, you want the lie? Here it is. You take all the other lies, the Antichrist saying he's Christ and he's going to make this one world. It's going to be a better place to live. I've got it all solved. Man is the measure of all things. Humanism is the lie. All right, you take it. Here's your dose of medicine. And you have self-induced misery to the maximum. Let's stop on that. Let's divide up again tonight into prayer groups. And could the men go back to the back room, please? And if the ladies could remain in here, could come up to the first several rows.